And Sid Griffin, our resident musicologist, is with us. Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you, Mark.
Have you been having a London festive period, or have you been home to Kentucky?
No. My sister came over from Alabama, so we were in North London, as you suspected. Right. Didn't get to go to Kentucky this time.
Right, okay. Now then, we're going to talk books. And the first one, The Birds. I mean, you have picked some kind of weighty tomes in your time. I mean, I think this is the longest biography of a band that's ever been written?
1,200 pages from my dear pal Johnny Rogan.
I mean, and it says volume one.
Yes, it says volume one. Is everyone that comes in my house and sees me says volume one. I mean, it looks like something in a murder case. You could have this, you know, if you whacked your toe with it, I mean, you'd break the toe. I mean, it's really something. It's got to be the definitive biography of any pop music act. I mean, it's way up there with everything on the Sinatra or the Beatles or Elvis. I mean, his research, Johnny Rogan's research, is just second to none.
I mean, incredible. Requiem for the Timeless, it's called. I mean, quite seriously, there is another volume coming, is there?
It's my understanding. Now, this may be wrong, but I spoke to him at the book launch, and there was a lot of people around him, but what I gleaned is volume two will have more on, say, sidelight bands like the International Submarine Band, the Flying Burrito Brothers, Dillard and Clark, and the solo careers of various Birds. Okay. This one is pretty much focused on the Birds and their centerpiece, Roger McGuinn.
Okay, we'll talk about that, but we'll have some music first from the Birds, and this is She Don't Care About Time.
Hallways and staircases, every day to climb. To my white ballroom, out on the end of time, where I can be with my love, for she is all that is mine, and she'll always be there, my love. Don't care about time. I laugh with her, cry with her, hold her close. She mine. The way she tells me of her love, how never is she trying. She don't have to be assured of many good things you find, and she'll always be there, my love. Don't care about time. Are dark and deep with love, her hair hangs long and fine. She walks with ease, and all she sees is never wrong or right. And with her arms around me tight, I see her all in my mind. And she'll always be there, my love. Don't care about time. She'll always be there, my love. Don't care about time.
Well, there you go. If you're coming new to the Birds, it's hard to imagine. It might be, but of course you might be. Sort of, you've never heard the Birds before. If you're coming new to the Birds, that is a beginner's guide right there, Sid Griffin, isn't it? All the elements are right there in that tune.
All the elements are right there in that tune. The great Gene Clark song, She Don't Care About Time, a beautiful McGuinn guitar solo with, I think, Michael Clark playing a little harmonica over it. Yeah. Just the great harmonies on the song, intelligent lyrics, which in 1965 wasn't that easy to find in a pop song. So there you go.
Yeah, and I know that, you know, you're a huge fan of the Birds. We're talking about the book specifically, and the Birds sort of shaped your kind of young life as kind of the way you looked and the way you sounded and the way your band, the Long Riders, approached things. I mean, do you think, you know, over it is like the Beatles and the Stones. Is it stating it too far that the stateside equivalent would be the Beach Boys and the Birds?
I think the Beach Boys and the Birds were the stateside equivalent of the Beatles and the Stones. And one of the interesting things about this book by Johnny Rogan, Requiem for the Timeless, Volume 1, is he points out how the Birds really should have been right behind the Stones in the number three slot instead of, say, maybe the Who or somebody. But they kind of blew it in their career, partly due to their own bickering and partly due to circumstances beyond their control. But it's something that Rogan really brings out in the book, and I think he does it in a fascinating way.
It is an extraordinary thing. It's an extraordinary achievement. Do you want? I mean, like, do you want 1,000 pages? I mean, is it obviously? You know, you've read the whole thing. I'll be honest with you, I haven't as of yet.
Funny
I don't
enough,
know whether I ever will. Do you need 1,000 pages on any band?
Let's put this in perspective, Mark. This is Johnny Rogan's 4th Birds biography. Right. He's written 3 previous. This is not just an updated one. He's really revamped the other books, which of course I read. And when I took it back from the media launch party from this book in mid-December, whenever it was, I thought, it's great, I'm flipping through it, I'm in Sid Griffin heaven. But you have to ask yourself how many Sid Griffins are out there. Yeah. And, I mean, I think it shows Rogan's very, very, he's written, I think it's 19 pop rock books now, biographies, whatever.
Yeah.
I think it shows Rogan's passion that he would go on with a 4th biography of the Birds and one that's 1,200 pages.
I mean, good writing, definitive. And no one questioned. I mean, the Morrissey and Marr, The Severed Alliance, was another big book of
his,
which
has
been constantly sold for the past 20 years and everything. I mean, does he outline, I mean, what's significant about the Birds? I mean, in the early stage, of course, they were the beneficiaries of kind of giving a pop sheen to Bob Dylan's tune. So people who perhaps didn't want kind of, you know, the Bob Dylan sound, but sort of appreciated what he was doing, the Birds sort of really benefited from that in the early days, didn't they?
Classic example is the aforementioned Alabama sister of yours, truly, who doesn't really like Bob Dylan at all, but, you know, would turn up the volume if Mr. Tambourine Man by the Birds came on, or You Ain't Going Nowhere by the Birds came on. She can fathom and get into that, musically speaking, but there's a lot of people out there that needed the Birds or Fairport Convention or Manfred Mann to make Dylan palatable for him. And McGuinn really should get, I don't know what, Dylan owes him a dinner, because what they did with his material, it made it so smooth and so easy to get to middle America. I mean, before Mr. Tambourine Man, Bob Dylan was going to be a wonderful, wonderful, powerful force, but he was never going to sell that many records and never break through to AM radio, and they really showed the way.
Right. I mean, all great rock biographies sort of need to be about more than the band. Because as you say, how many Sid Griffins, how many people are there who are absolutely determined to know every lineup change of the Birds? You know, there are a few. You know, but, I mean, all these books to work, they really have to kind of be snapshots of the times they come through. So does this book, do you think, sort of capture that idealism and hedonism of the 60s and then the rise, you know, of the kind of the drug culture of the 70s and everything? Does it capture those moods?
I think it does, and I think it does, Mark, in a way that's so real. The Birds themselves, those members of the Birds from day one to when they broke up, I think a lot of them may dislike the book at times or period, because it shows them to be, you know, wildly human, to put it diplomatically, but at times just, you know, bickering when they had the world just at their feet, and they just kind of conspired to, they didn't conspire to blow it. That's way too harsh, but they weren't the phenomenon that they should have been. And I'll tell you, this is something that his books illustrate so well, how they sort of get into the backstabbing and all that. But it's the phenomenon of all the West Coast bands that were harmony bands, be it the Birds, the Beach Boys, the Buffalo Springfield, the Mamas and the Papas, or even the Bangles later on. All of these bands, as terrific as they were, fought like cats and dogs backstage.
There's some kind of really a potent and pithy point about, you know, harmony on stage but not off in there, isn't it?
Yes, and Rogan, he makes that point, and he cites chapter and verse. This isn't, you and I, I know many of your listeners have read biographies of people, maybe not in just the entertainment world, but outside, where a lot of it's conjecture. Yet this guy, Johnny Rogan, can cite chapter and verse. He's got the quotes, he's got the stories. I mean, people back him up. It's quite an impressive amount of research, but it's sad that the story, in a way, doesn't have a happier ending, because the Birds, it should have meant more than it did. And it's kind of sad, because as you say, how many Sid Griffins are out there, they're going to read this? And I think, going back to your original question, if you could just hand this to a Martian and say, let me explain the 1960s pop music scene to you, that alien creature would be able to read this and go, yeah, got it, I understand.
Yeah, because you get the Stones and the Beatles who sort of come into this yarn, don't they?
They do, and Dylan, and what a great band you are, of both Dylan and the Rolling Stones and the Beatles, all three, say you're a great American group. Now, that's pretty heady stuff.
I mean, what was the? Could they just not get on for long enough? Or was there a kind of a desire to kind of keep moving? Obviously, you get the Gram Parsons era, and you get when the Byrds kind of go into headlong into country rock, and sort of more or less, some would say, kind of inventing it at that point. And some Byrds fans up to that point, for them, it's almost like Dylan. It's almost a Judas moment, kind of embracing the great kind of redneck music, isn't it?
Well, part of it, I feel the Byrds acrimonious backstage. McGuinn once explained it to me that they were like a pirate ship. And I think that's a pretty good metaphor. It seems that because Roger McGuinn was a he's not the passionate guy that, say, a David Crosby is, that people sort of in the band thought they could cross him. When at the end of the day, it is a focus on Roger McGuinn's 12-string guitar and those laconic Dylan crossed with John Lennon vocals. And yet, one by one, it seems everybody in the band at one time or another seems to want to challenge him on that for the leadership of the group. Mm. And it just makes for a fascinating read, in my opinion, even if you don't know much about the Byrds. But again, who's going to stay with it for all that long?
Yeah, I mean, we should say it's not even public. I think its official publication date is the end of this week on the 6th.
I believe it is.
And it's £20, which, I mean, you know, it seems a fair price for the amount of stuff that you're getting, in a way. You know, some good photos in there. The thing about the Byrds changing, and this has always been something I've noticed, but Roger McGuinn is kind of a changeling himself. He rarely looks the same in two photos.
It's fascinating. What I do love about the Byrds is I don't think there's any time in their career when they made the three records in a row that were the same sound. You got the two folk rock ones, then you got a changing one with 5D, then Younger Than Yesterday and Notorious are sort of, they're very much psychedelic pop rock records. Then they go straight country and western. Then they start fooling around with what the people in Sunvolt, that wonderful American band, said was the beginning of Americana, with the late 60s albums and 1970s Untitled. They didn't stay the same, and that's fascinating. But of course, that will lose you an audience. If you're Creedence Clearwater Revival, or if you're the Ramones, and you have, or a heavy metal band, and you have pretty much the same sound over and over, and you polish it and you refine it, but you don't change it, it allows you to pick up more people in the marketplace as you go on because they become more familiar with your work. McGuinn and company kept overthrowing their own ship. They kept causing mutiny on their own voyage, and it's just fascinating. It's great for art, it's great for adventure, but it's no real way to run your career.
Talking to Sid Griffin about Johnny Rogan's book Byrds Requiem for the Timeless, Volume 1. Here's The Bells of Rhymney.
Oh, what will you give me? Say the sad bells of Rhymney. Is there hope for the future? Say the brown bells of Merthyr. Who made the night on air? Say the black bells of Rhymney. And you killed the miner, say the grim bells of Lyna. Through the Vandals in court, say the bells of Newport. All will be well if say the green bells of Cardiff. Why so worried, sisters, why? Say the silver bells of wine. And what will you give me? Say the sad bells of Rhymney. Give me,
Talking to Sid Griffin about the Byrds and the new biography by Johnny Rogan, Requiem for the Timeless, Volume 1. That's an talking to Sid Griffin, it's an extraordinary song for them to have done in many ways, The Bells of Rhymney, which is kind of, I think, Pete Seeger, but the words were by Idris Davis, a Welsh poet, talking about the general strike.
In 1926.
And it's almost like a kind of Oranges and Lemons with the different bells of the different kind of pit villages and everything, isn't it, really? So what the Byrds knew of all that, I mean, you know, I suppose that, you know, they might have picked up some knowledge from that.
Roger McGuinn has always been sort of, in the way that Jagger and Richards took blues, you know, Howlin' Wolf and Muddy Waters, and introduced it to people like me in the United States. I didn't know who Wolf and Muddy Waters were. Yeah. I heard the Stones. That McGuinn's, let's give some credit here. McGuinn's done that with folk music, and Hillman's done that with country and western. Through the Byrds, I learned about things like Pete Seeger, who I'm a huge fan of Pete Seeger. And through the Byrds, I learned about things like George Jones. And now I love country and western, as we well know. I mean, anyone that knows me. But I think that's been great that they've been a focus or a funnel or able to point the way and say, land ho, this is good too, in a way that's unheralded. I mean, I didn't know till recently that the first two Beatle albums had those Talma Motown covers on them, and you couldn't get those originals in the UK because Motown didn't have a distribution deal in the UK.
Right.
I only thought the Stones were sort of the band saying, land ho, there's blues out there. I didn't realize both the Beatles and the Byrds made their contribution too.
We talked about the, you know, the Beatles and the Stones and all the kind of influences and the Howlin' Wolf and the Pete Seeger and all that. Tim makes an interesting point. He says, I think the Byrds got a lot of their sound from the Searchers.
A lot of people say that over here in the UK, and McGuinn will be frank. He says the 12-string, some of that 12-string was with the Searchers, but then his lead playing, the Searchers couldn't touch. I mean, I'm a Searchers fan, but the lead playing, no one in the Searchers could touch, which is based on weird things like Bach. And then, of course, Roger always talks about the wonderful solo on She's Not There by the Zombies, where Rod Argent's all over the keyboard. Well, that's kind of gave McGuinn the idea that, why should I stick with the pentatonic scale and rhythm and blues riffs? Let's take it all over the fretboard.
Well, that's it, like Amos and John Coltrane and all those kind of things. Someone else who was very influenced by that song, the Byrds version of The Bells of Rhymney in particular, this dovetails very neatly, was George Harrison, wasn't it?
This is true. The late, great George Harrison wrote If I Needed Someone, one of his early Beatle classics, based on just the solo that Roger played on the great Bells of Rhymney. And, of course, today Roger pronounces it the correct way. It's Rhymney, as all my Welsh friends tease me.
Well, okay.
All my Welsh friends say, why didn't the Byrds get that right? As if I know?
Well, I should know. Oh, and I'm getting it wrong even now.
Yeah, well, it's Rhymney. But no, Harrison was a huge fan of McGuinn. And during the Byrds as well, during the Traveling Wilbury days, Mark, I remember George Harrison was live taking phone calls on some American late night, I think it was Sunday night, nationally broadcast syndicated show. And he was playing something, and he went into Bells of Rhymney and then something else. He was just fooling around
Rhymney.
The guitar. Rhymney. And he goes, we love you, Jim McGuinn. And I got a kick out of that because McGuinn changed his name to Roger in, I think, late 67, early 68. But George Harrison was still saying Jim McGuinn back in the Wilbury days.
And there's a George Harrison book. I mean, obviously we saw the Scorsese documentary towards the end of last year. But there's Living in a Material World by Olivia Harrison, which is kind of a picture book, wonderful picture book, $26.99. So quite an investment. Mm-hmm. But I mean, it is we've used the word snapshot of the times, and in every way, this kind of documents Harrison's life.
It's a wonderful coffee table book of Harrison's life. There have been some people saying there's not enough Beatles in it, and so on and so forth. But I mean, come on, the Fab Four are out there, folks. What I find fascinating about Living in the Material World, both the DVD and the book, are they firmly put George Harrison on equal footing with Lennon and McCartney. I mean, certainly as a human being, he was unique, a one-off. There was no one like him. So many people that have made a pile in pop music, to a certain extent, spend it on themselves or frittered away. And here's a guy that not only did the charity thing with the concert for Bangladesh and kicking all that off, did a lot of charity work on the side, and helped, helped save British cinema with his handmade films. They made some classic films when he got involved with The Python's Life of Brian. And from there on in, got into the film industry. I mean, you can't say many bad things about the guy from that angle. George Harrison made a huge contribution, besides his popular music successes, in his charitable work and in his work with the film industry. He's just done, and then the preservation of that Friar Park. It's just amazing what he's done. Harrison's, he's made his mark, and I think the book and the DVD are giving him a belated due.
I mean, what I love about this book is particularly the early stuff when he's kind of, of course, Olivia would have access to this stuff, his personal letters and postcards, really sweet things, like a postcard he sent to Mr. and Mrs. G. Caldwell in Ontario. When he's in Inverness, he says, "I have been spending the week in Inverness, so I thought you might like to have another reminder of the place. The rock and roll group I am in is backing a well-known English rock star around this area, and we are doing one-night stands at dance halls. We played at Forest last night, I will write when I get home." It's really sweet, and sort of his handwritten kind of, when he's trying to learn how to play guitar and write songs, when he's written out the little sort of finger-dotted chord charts and things.
I love the little bits of lyrics. He's written lyrics on the hotel stationery on the backs of envelopes and so on and so forth, as you do. And Mark, I just love that they've included that in there because it makes him very human. He, too, inspired to write a classic, Can't Find a Piece of Paper.
I know. It is great because, these photo books come out and you think, yeah, well, they're very nice to flick through just once and everything. And they are, I suppose, very much for the fans. But I think it is right to point out that you will get things that, you thought, well, do we need a George Harrison film of that length? There was stuff that hadn't been seen before, stuff you didn't know. And there are just little kind of humanizing snippets, aren't there, in this that you haven't seen before.
Well, I was knocked sideways by the Scorsese documentary. I thought it was really wonderful. And the book is, it's because it's his misses, it's a little more, it's a little more gentle on George. The Scorsese documentary, in my opinion, and I think many others, was good because it showed some less than pleasant lights about George. It put him in a very human spotlight. It made him more of one of the crowd. And this book's back to he was this, he was that, and he was very saintly at times. And it's wonderful. I do think, as you say, that the human parts of it are the best, writing home to his folks and his relatives and so on and so forth. And then I love on page 200 to 201, ladies and gentlemen, there's pictures of him, get ready, playing tennis with Bob Dylan. Neither one in tennis garb or sneakers, and they have unique tennis form. But just things like that make it very human. I mean, they're on the Isle of Wight. Dylan's going to play on the Isle of Wight. There's two tennis rackets. Let's have a go. I love things like that, that it's not just a book of him triumphing and always with dignitaries and next to the prime minister or doing this or doing that. I love the little things of him. This is one of him riding some sort of a motor scooter as a small boy, and it's just a wonderfully endearing side of the guy.
George Harrison, Living in the Material World. Olivia Harrison, it's out now. Abrams Books. Sid, great talking to you.
Great talking to you, Mark.
And here are the Beatles, If I Needed Someone.